WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Thank you for joining us for another edition, your Labor Day edition of Monday Night Talk. My name is indeed Kevin Tachi. We have a great show lined up for you today. We will be speaking with some folks who definitely want your attention because, well, for some folks, it is campaign season. We'll start off, of course, though, with a good friend of this radio program, none other than author Dave Wedge. Dave here to chat a little bit this evening about the launch of, actually, there's a big event that's going to be tomorrow. They're talking about the launch of the book, which is officially going to take place on the 18th. But they get a big event, Pete Frady's Day. And so that's going to be taking place in Boston. Dave will give us the details, kind of talk to us about, you know, the official launch of the book and what's going on with that. Then we'll have a chance to speak with some candidates. We'll start with Dan Shores. Remember Dan? Dan ran for Congress. Dan also had a radio program on here for some time. And Dan is actually going to come in to talk tonight about his run, not for Congress, but this time he is going to run for Attorney General. Of course, you know, the Attorney General's term isn't up until 2018, but he's getting out there early and begun campaigning, and he thought he would stop here. We'll do a little catching up with Dan to find out what he is up to, or what he has been up to, and what's behind this run for Attorney General. And then we'll turn our focus to another set of races. Of course, this is something that is more so just a couple of weeks away. City of Brockton, they hold their city elections every 2 years. Now, if you've listened to this program, this show, on a regular basis, that you know that over the past few weeks, we have done our best to have candidates come in, whether they are running for office or maybe they're incumbents, give them an opportunity. Last week, I had a chance to hear Mayor Bill Carpenter chat for a few moments. This week, we have two folks who they're actually looking to get the word out about that campaign because it could be very crucial come September 19th. That's when the city preliminary is. So we have running for Ward 6 City Council, Joanne Zingmunt, and running for Mayor, Mike Carroll. Well, both of those races, I believe, are going to appear on the preliminary ballot. So we'll have them in here and kind of get some insights into them as candidates, why they're running, and, hopefully what they would like to do if they are successful come November's general election. And then, you know, interesting enough, we're sitting here on Labor Day, and, you know, there was a time that it was after Labor Day you would go back to school. That has changed. As we know, last week a lot of the schools were active here on the South Shore on all levels, whether it's preschool, kindergarten, elementary school, middle school, high school, and I think this week probably more so will be colleges as the kids are moving back in to get ready to start taking classes. We got Dr. Kate Roberts. Remember her? We've had her on in the past, and she is going to offer up tips to parents to get kids ready to go back to school. So stay tuned. We have a great show lined up for you this evening.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's Smoke Shop. Message me directly on Brennan's Smoke Shop's Facebook page.
This guy drives me nuts. He's so annoying. I'm going to message him on Facebook right now.
Hey, it's Jeff from Facebook.
Oh.
Adam, were you just going to message me on Facebook for no good reason? Huh?
How are you doing this?
Adam, everyone knows I'm everywhere all at once. I'm in your car. I'm on your phone. I'm on your computer. With the power of radio broadcasting, I'm everywhere. You can't hide from me. I'm Jeff from Brennan's Smoke Shop.
Get out of my radio. Stop it, Jeffrey. Get out of my phone. Help.
Adam, wake up.
I won't message anymore.
Wake up.
Please, stop. Just go away.
Wake up.
Oh, I was having a nightmare.
It was only a dream. Everything's going to be fine.
No, it's not. It's Jeff from Brennan's Smoke Shop.
Oh! It's a nightmare.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's Smoke Shop. Message me directly on Brennan's Smoke Shop's Facebook page.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Well, thank you for keeping your radio dial set here to 95.9WATD and kicking off our Labor Day edition of Monday Night Talk. Is a good friend and author, Dave Wedge, calling in, joining us on the eve of a big event. Tomorrow, the launch of Ice Bucket Challenge, Pete Frady's in the fight against ALS, and there's also going to be a big event at City Hall Plaza. Dave, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
How are you, Kevin? Happy Labor Day.
Yeah, happy Labor Day to you as well. I know you've been a busy guy. We had Casey, and we had Casey as part of a big thing. I think it was on your birthday at the
summer.
Yeah, this summer, yep. The Kingston Council on Aging, and now it's the big event is here. You're about to launch yet another book. Talk to me about the book, the Ice Bucket Challenge.
Yeah, we're real excited about this one. You know, it's a lot of people know the Ice Bucket Challenge. They did it a couple of years ago when it, you know, became that viral sensation that raised a couple hundred million dollars. It actually became the biggest social media fundraising campaign in history. But not a lot of people know the whole story about the people behind the Ice Bucket Challenge and how it came to be. And, locally, some people know a little bit about Pete Frady's because he's obviously, you know, very visible guy. He's out there in the news a lot. But we were lucky enough to spend a lot of time with the Frady's family and a lot of their friends and people in the BC community and the baseball community, and just really get to know this family's story and Pete's story. And that's what the book's about. It's about, you know, it's not about a guy who gets sick. And it's really about a family's love in the face of tall odds and how they respond to that. And how they responded is they created the Ice Bucket Challenge and they galvanized as a family. You know, the family really turned themselves into a corporation and a marketing machine. And they took this Ice Bucket Challenge around the world and raised more money for ALS than has ever been raised in the history of mankind. And also along the way, they changed the way that corporations and businesses look at social media and how it can be a tool for awareness and fundraising.
Talk to us. You're coming off, you know, the Boston Strong book. You're teaming up. You're teaming up again with Casey Sherman. You guys seem like the dynamic duo when it comes to putting together ventures like this. You guys are partners in a production company. Talk to me about continued success with this book.
Yeah. So we're very excited. The book comes out tomorrow, and we have the big event at City Hall Plaza at 2 p.m. Boston City Hall with Mayor Walsh, and he'll be honoring Pete Frady's, naming September 5th Pete Frady's Day in the city of Boston. And Pete's from Beverly, but he went to Boston College, and, you know, he's had such an impact on the community and around the world, but in Boston specifically. You know, he's been at the Patriots games, he's been at the Bruins games and the Red Sox. The Red Sox are a huge partner with Pete and all the stuff he's doing to raise awareness for ALS and raise money to fight this horrible disease. So it's awesome that Mayor Walsh is doing this, and the BC Marching Band is going to be there, and the Boston College baseball team, and Sam Kennedy and Tom Werner from the Red Sox will be there. And you know, I think Casey and I have mentioned to you before that we are working on a movie about this book, and we've partnered with an amazing producer out in Hollywood, woman named Allison Greenspan, who she's just really passionate about this. She has some family connection to ALS, and we just love the story, and we think that it's going to make an incredible movie, and we hope to have some news on that soon. And that movie will be, Casey and I will be co-producers on that movie through our production company, Witta Productions, that we started right after Patriots Day last year.
And I have to say this, it's great that this day is taking place tomorrow, the big Pete Frates Day at City Hall Plaza, even knowing that he was part of a prank that said that Pete had met his demise.
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you, Kevin, and I feel bad saying this, but I really didn't think Pete was going to be around to enjoy this celebration of his life with this book. When Casey and I started this project a couple of years ago, you know, the doctors and the family themselves told us that Pete was really day-to-day way back then. That was 2 years ago.
Right.
And they didn't, you know, no one really knew how long he was going to be able to fight this. And the reality of the situation is that ALS is a 2 to 5 year diagnosis, and it's terminal. There's no cure. There's no treatment. So Pete's already passed that 5 years. So, but he's stronger than ever, as long as I've known him. Since, you know, he had this issue this summer where he was in Mass General and that unfortunate incident that you mentioned where Mike Barnicle tweeted out that he had died, claiming that someone close to the family had told him that, which obviously wasn't true. Mm. What that did really was it got Pete mad, and it got him angry, and it fired him up. And that competitive spirit that he's had his whole life really came out, and it's stronger than ever right now where he's like, oh, yeah, you think I'm gone? Well, watch this. You know, it's that kind of attitude. And in the past couple of weeks, Pete's been really more engaged with us than he has been since we started the project. He's messaging us almost daily. You know, he's setting up media interviews himself. You know, he's reaching out to his friends in the media. The family is doing the Today Show. They're doing a bunch of, you know, national TV interviews. He's talking to Nesson. He's, you know, he's just really fired up and excited about it. And he's going to be there tomorrow. You know, he's going to be there at City Hall. And then we have a big book launch at Fenway Park on the 18th, and he's going to be there for that. So, and we're even planning, you know, we've got a couple events in New York at the end of the month. And Julie, Pete's wife, told us that he's planning to travel to New York and come to those with us. So, it's so inspiring to see what this guy is doing and just fighting this disease.
Are you ready for the marathon with, you know, all the media tour and the book signings? Are you ready for this next wave?
Yeah, it's a lot, you know, but it's look, this is, you know, what we work for, Casey and I, when we do these books. And, you know, it's not about, you know, celebrating ourselves. At least I don't look at it that way. I look at it as celebrating these stories, yep, that we're able to tell. You know, the marathon survivors, you know, we became really close with them. We talked about that in the past, and we did a lot of charitable events for the marathon survivors and different causes that they were associated with. And it makes me proud to be able to do that stuff while selling a book that I wrote and you know, making a living at what I do. And you know, this is the same thing. You know, we're splitting the proceeds from the book 50-50 with the Frates family. So every book that's sold, half of that money goes directly to the Frates family, and there aren't really many authors that do that, to be honest with you. I'm not patting myself on the back, but it's not a normal thing, you know. But we did it with the Frates family because this story is so powerful that we think it's going to really capture the imagination of the country and the world, and Pete and his family really need that money right now. They're fighting for his life, literally, where he has hospital bills that are medical bills that are approach $100,000 a month.
Wow.
It's unsustainable. And, you know, whatever way we can help, whatever little bit we can help, we're going to do that. And all these book events that we're doing have some sort of charitable component. And, you know, the event tomorrow with Mayor Walsh, is just another example. You know, the media is going to be there, and it'll just raise that awareness. And, you know, there's a lot of causes out there that people can donate to, and we would ask them to consider ALS.
All right. Well, Dave, that's all the time we have to tease this segment. We will hope that after the launch of the book on the 18th, we find a way to get you and or Casey in studio and talk more about the book and how things are going at that particular time.
Yeah, we'd love to. And, you know, we just thank you so much for the support, Kevin, and it's great. And hope everyone reads the book.
There you go. There he is, Dave Wedge, a co-author with the Casey Sherman of the Ice Bucket Challenge. Pete Frates and the Fight Against ALS. Big event, City Hall Plaza tomorrow between 2 and 3 p.m. If you ain't doing anything, get on down there, support a great cause and a great guy. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, your Labor Day edition. And our next guest happens to be a gentleman who, well, you might remember him from a couple of different avenues. Now, if he hasn't represented you for a case, now I don't know what he does for law. We'll get into that. He used to do a radio show here, and I think he ran for Congress. am I wrong, Mr. Dan Shores?
Kevin, nice to see you. Thanks for having me here. You are correct.
You're tuned into the Dan Shores Show.
The Shores Report.
The Shores Report.
We had a lot of fun on those Friday evenings.
So now you're going to have to take a different approach because from what I'm understanding, instead of running for Congress and it being a district, you're going to run for a state office. You're going to run for Attorney General. Is that correct?
That's correct. Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Wow. And so why are you deciding to launch your campaign now? Why not wait till next year?
Well, we wanted to get started. I went through a deliberative process over the course of several months evaluating the current Attorney General's record. And I felt that it warranted me to put my hat in the ring. And we wanted to get as started as soon as we could in this year. And then we'd also going to, you know, go into next year with a full head of steam.
Talk to me about now, reminding folks as to you as a person, as I started out by introducing you as an attorney. What kind of law do you practice?
After my congressional race, I founded an intellectual property firm. We have an office in Boston and also down in D.C. And I grew up on the South Shore, but I spent 13 years in Washington, D.C., and I went to law school down there. It was an honor to attend Georgetown University Law Center. I was recruited out of law school, and I spent a great deal of time working with top law firms as a litigator in federal district court, in federal appellate courts, and worked with some of the best lawyers in the country, best litigators in the country, worked against and competed against some of the best litigators in the country, and I developed a passion for litigation. And now I'm back here. And the subject matter of that litigation was primarily intellectual property down there. And so I founded the firm following the race, and here we are.
How about as far as municipal or civic stuff? Maybe you serve on a nonprofit board or something. Give us some of the stuff that you've done, whether you've been elected or you've been appointed or you're sitting on a board.
Sure. I'm a trustee at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. I was appointed by Governor Baker 2 years ago. Recently, the board appointed me to chair the finance committee, and the finance committee is responsible responsible for overseeing the Academy's budget, which exceeds $50 million. So there's that. Certainly, you know, I following law school, I mean, following undergraduate, I worked in the inner city Boston as someone who helped integrate technology into the inner city Boston public schools, including for at the Jeremiah Burke High School in Dorchester and the Rafael Hernandez School as well. So I've had, you know, I've done service to the Commonwealth independent of, you know, other items.
It's interesting you talk about the Maritime Academy having a $50 million annual budget. I mean, most communities, small communities here on the South Shore, that's, you know, the average between $35 and $50 million. Like, you know, managing a small school.
That's right.
So what did you learn from your running for Congress, running for, you know, a district seat? What did you learn from that, and how are you going to use that in this run for AG?
I learned so much. I learned that you got to keep fighting. I learned that you have to. It changes every single day, every hour of every day. Something changes. And you to stay competitive, you really have to, you know, constantly analyze the information in front of you, analyze the situation, and then make decisions accordingly. But at the same time, you always have to stay on message. You always have to remember who you are, stay true to your values. And there's a lot of people in this business that want to tell you to do one thing or want to tell you to do the other thing. And at the end of the day, I always trust my instincts. And I trust myself, and that's usually what I end up going with. Actually, always end up what I end up going with. But I also like to take the information away from all the different sources, because there's always some kernel of good advice that comes from everybody. And I just take that all in and match it up with what my conscience is, what my mind says, what my heart says, and then go forward. I learned a tremendous amount. We did very well. We won. We finished. We didn't win the primary, but we did win Plymouth County in terms of total votes. And the best result is that I met my wife. I met my wife, Lindsay, during the campaign. We were married last summer, and that is by far the biggest victory that I could have ever hoped for.
That is fantastic. Definitely fantastic. How do you take it from running for Congress to now this is something that you're going to have to work the state? You're going to have to go around the Commonwealth, the 351 communities that makes up Massachusetts, and speak to folks as to your ideals to hopefully be the next AG.
That's right. It's you know, the 9th congressional district, that was a big race in itself, but certainly a statewide race is much larger. And so I loved every minute of the campaign for Congress. I understand the dynamic is different with the statewide race, and we're really looking forward to that. And we feel that we have a very strong message. We feel that the message of common sense, getting the office of the getting the politics out of the office of Attorney General is very important. I think that message is more important now than it has ever been. I think the office is more politicized now than it has ever been. And so I think my message will reach the vast majority of citizens in our Commonwealth. And I'm looking forward to spreading that message.
What have been the issues that have sparked you as Dan Shore is the candidate for Attorney General? What are some of the things that you've come out of the current administration and you said, is that really an issue? Is that something the AG should be talking about? And if I was AG, kind of complete that sentence.
Sure. Again, the office has become very political. The sitting Attorney General has made a point to consistently attack, focus on issues that are there that don't directly affect. Maybe they touch, but they don't directly affect the citizens here in Massachusetts. Here's an example. Over the past year, the Attorney General's office has already filed 25 lawsuits against the federal administration. Now, that's about a lawsuit a week, or maybe it's a lawsuit every 2 weeks or somewhere in the middle. That's quite a bit of activity. My concern is that the resources of the office are not being directed towards things that directly affect people here at home. And for example, we should spend less time focusing on these heavy national issues that are dealt with more appropriately by the delegation, by the Massachusetts delegation, by politicians than the Attorney General's office. We should be focusing on issues like the opioid crisis, much more focus on the opioid crisis. I understand the Attorney General has done some work there, and she should be commended for that. However, the sitting attorney general is soft on crime. It does not support mandatory minimum sentences for drug traffickers. That's something that I strongly support. And I think we need to the instrumentality of the Office of Attorney General needs to return to its law enforcement focus and focus on people here at home.
One of the things you mentioned, which is something that's on a lot of people's minds, that is the opioid epidemic, the crisis itself. What are some of the things that, if you are, you know, A, fortunate enough to get the Republican nod as an AG, and then you're successful in November 2018, what would you like to tackle in regards to getting out education and information and dealing with the opioid epidemic?
Sure. I believe it is a two-pronged problem, mainly a two-pronged problem. One is the addiction. But let me focus on the first one, which is law enforcement. I think that putting the full force and weight behind law enforcement efforts, cracking down on drug traffickers, again, utilization of tools for that the local officials can use, such as mandatory minimum sentences, helping with that on the legislative level, Beacon Hill pushing that, using the bully pulpit of the office to push that, and also working with the local district attorneys and sheriffs in cracking on drug traffickers. And I think that's a major distinguishing feature between myself and the Attorney General, is that I will be tough on crime, very tough on crime. Anyone who profits off of this poison, if you're going to be profiting off this poison, you need to know that you're going to receive the full force and weight of the law, and that you're taking a big risk by doing that, and there will be consequences. On the other side, we have the obvious issue with the crisis. We all know it crosses socioeconomic boundaries, where everyone has been touched in one way or another by this crisis, and it is a plague, and we see it on a daily basis. We all see it in our lives. And I believe at the very, very root of that issue is education. I think the push on education for prevention is so, so very important. Don't get started on the first place, especially with these drugs. These drugs in particular, one strike and you could be out. Two strikes and you could be out. And out has different meanings. One meaning is you could die. I mean, it's very real. Our deaths, people die. It's really an epidemic. And then also some people that seek to recover, they're affected for the rest of their lives, and their families are affected. And so just the education, the real strong leadership at the local level in schools and other areas, is don't get started on this stuff in the first place. And I think that's very important. And then there's also, I guess there might be a third prong, but it's the treatment. How are we helping people who have fallen into this trap? How do we help them get up, get on their feet? And those are issues I think the Attorney General's office can certainly help direct resources, assist with that. But I think primarily the office's function is a law enforcement function, and that's what I will focus on very strongly.
You talk about the Oxycontin, oxycodone, you know, that the pain pills. You talk about heroin, but the latest to come into focus in that law enforcement is dealing with in the I know that I've seen a couple of and heard of a couple of different news reports in regards to a particular drug incapacitating emergency workers, like a carfentanil or fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your thoughts on how tough the AG's office should be or should be leading the charge when it comes to somebody who is trafficking or selling or dealing carfentanil or fentanyl.
Oh, I mean, absolutely, Kevin. This fentanyl is worse than poison. I mean, some officers, if you come in contact with that, some officers
just breathe it in.
Exactly, it's unbelievable. It's literally poison that's going through our streets. So, the Attorney General's office should be extremely tough on this issue. Extremely tough on this issue, and at the same time, respecting the local officials, respecting the role of the district attorney, the sheriff. They're on the front lines. They see it. They're involved. They're right on the front lines. So it's providing as much support as possible on the local level. Now, this is an interjurisdictional issue, drug trafficking throughout our state. So it's certainly within the purview and scope of the Attorney General's office. So, like I say, the full force and weight, support whatever we can. And the bottom line is getting the job done and getting these traffickers off the streets.
What are some of the other provisions, some of the other duties of the Attorney General's office that folks may or may not know, the little known items that you would like to focus on, but you feel that are being lost in how the office is being politicized?
Well, I think one primary example is public corruption. This sitting attorney general has not confronted any major issue concerning public corruption. I've seen no major cases relating to public corruption. And I think a common sense view of that is can we really assume that there's no public corruption actually taking place? And I think the answer would be no. I think we always have to have an aggressive attorney general who's going to take a look inside in the government instrumentality and elsewhere to determine if everything is being operated on the up and up. And that's something that I will provide.
I think the other thing I wanted to ask you, you know, my understanding of the AG's office is it's the, you know, they work for the people of the Commonwealth, and if there's somebody who's out there taking advantage of a situation, whether it's an individual who is seeking benefits that they don't deserve, or if it's a corporation that is doing something illegally, that they are taken, they are prosecuted, and fines are levied. Talk to me about being able to be the people's attorney here for the Commonwealth.
Absolutely. And there's something called the False Claims Act. It's a federal law, and there's also a state False Claims Act law. And in many areas, that's used to protect the public fisc, such as MassHealth. And if someone is committing fraud against MassHealth, for example, someone's overbilling, there's a whistleblower statute that allows an individual to blow the whistle on the entity company that is committing fraud against the Commonwealth. And that's a very useful tool for the Attorney General's office to then prosecute and recover the funds from the loss of funds from the fraud. And the damages are triple. They're triple damages for those who commit fraud against our public funds.
I guess the other thing I would ask you, if we talk about that, how about as far as, I mean, looking into whether it's workers' rights, looking into housing issues. We know mm-hmm. these are things that are very prevalent in our everyday life. Talk to me about as far as addressing and keeping an eye on those particular issues when it comes to being a caretaker, the attorney for the people.
Absolutely. And I'm a consumer myself, so consumer rights are actually very, very important to me. Some individuals, they don't have the protection, they don't have the resources, and they're getting screwed. And no one likes that. And certainly the Attorney General's office shouldn't like that. And I would not like that. And so we would, provide resources for those individuals and support them to the fullest extent of the law. We will be there for the people of Massachusetts, for those, regardless of what their status may be economically, socially. We want to be a champion. The Attorney General's office should be a champion for all people in our Commonwealth.
When it comes to running for this office, what have you done so far to get your campaign? I mean, your first stop here was a good one, but what are some of the things that you're doing to mobilize your campaign for office?
Yeah, and so I'm a disciple of Bill Belichick, so I don't like to reveal my entire game plan, sure. We've launched our campaign. We launched our campaign very recently. We have our organization together. We have staff. We're building staff. We're raising funds, and we're organizing events, and we're going to be doing that continuously throughout this year and into next year.
Now, who do you have overseeing your campaign, and how did you choose that particular person?
There's a gentleman. His name is Mike Pollack. He's our campaign manager, and he's a lawyer as well, which is very nice. And he's a very energetic and bright young man, and we're really looking forward to working with him during this race.
So what are you doing as far as getting out there? I mean, is this going to be something where you're just having events and people come to you? I mean, it's not going to be the conventional door-knocking type of a thing. And it isn't necessarily where you're going to be, you know, attending, but, you know, attending other candidates' events. But what are you doing to get out there and campaign and get the word out about you running for AG?
Sure. You know, we are planning events, and we're also going to be attending, key events. We're going to be speaking to, a lot of the key stakeholders, and also people that are important for certain issues throughout the state. Certainly, folks that are very knowledgeable relating to the opioid crisis. We're going to continue to speak with those folks. I've already spoken with a number of district attorneys and sheriffs, and better understand what their role is in that issue and other issues. And so we're basically being strategic about how we use our time and resources. And but that's generally the approach that we're going to take. And then that's where I'm going to cut it off. I'm going to do the Bill Belichick and say no.
I have to ask you this. What we're living these days, what we've lived for the past, do I say a little bit more than 18 months from the presidential election that took place last summer into the fall to swearing in a new president. We have an unorthodox individual who is in the White House, who is running our country at this particular time, but it seems as though it's an interesting time in politics, depending on where you pick, and it seems as though there's not necessarily, depending on who you back and depending on who you support, it's a matter of whether it's a gray area, if you're an alt-left or an alt-right. Give me your thoughts on the state of today's politics, and being somebody who's running for office, what do you have to do to navigate, a campaign, and be careful of getting in too deep with some individuals or some parties?
That's a great question. I mean, certainly it's a very very chaotic political time here. And I'm a lifelong Republican. I've been a Republican for my first vote when I was 18. I'm currently 45. I'm a Reagan Republican. And I've lived in Massachusetts and D.C., two of the more liberal places, and it's fine. I mean, I it certainly tested what my beliefs were, and so I stay true to that. I've stayed true to that my whole life, and ultimately, when you have extreme viewpoints, I think makes me a little uncomfortable on either side. I think we have common sense. I think we need to make good judgments based on common sense and proper analysis, and that's why I believe that, and that's why I really like this role to serve in the Attorney General's office, because the Attorney General's office should not be about politics. I mean, that's why I'm running for this office. The office has become too politicized; it's lost its legal compass. The office of Attorney General should be about the law. It should be about facts. It should be about fairness, and politics shouldn't factor into it. So there could be a political a hurricane surrounding me in the role of the AG, but in terms of the law is concerned, I will be at the eye of that storm. I will represent the people of this Commonwealth without passion or prejudice.
So you feel like weighing in on Second Amendment rights, a certain weaponry that should be allowed to be used in the Commonwealth, or immigration and how it's handled, are things that should be left up to
the legislature. Absolutely. And with respect to the Second Amendment, I think I'm a constitutional conservative. In the spirit of John Adams, I believe that you can't pick and choose your rights and your civil rights and the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment is one of our civil liberties. And this sitting attorney general overreached with the guidance that was provided from her office. And overreached, and basically told so many law-abiding gun owners in this state that they're not acting legally, and I think it was done in a legislative manner. Now as the attorney general, you wait until the law you enforce the law, you enforce what the legislature and the governor signs that legislation into law, what they did, and you look at that, and then you move from there. What I think the attorney general did in that circumstance was to make law, and it's not just my opinion. It's also the opinion of several high-ranking Democrats pushed back on that action, along with Republicans, as if you were to look at it politically, that you might expect that. But high-ranking Democrats did as well, and they rebuked the Attorney General because they said, you can't act as a legislator. You're in the role of Attorney General to enforce the law and not make the law. And as the next Attorney General, I will enforce the law, whatever the law is. I will enforce it and represent the people in this Commonwealth without passion or prejudice.
Okay, we're speaking with Dan Shores. Dan is running for, he's announcing his campaign that he's running for Attorney General right here in Massachusetts. And it seems 2018 is going to be, we thought that last year was a big year, but would you agree that 2018 is going to be another big year, especially for Massachusetts politics, and as well, you know, the midterms for the president, depending on if he can retain and keep his numbers in the House and the Senate and be able to keep that majority. Give me your thoughts on being a part of a big election year.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think the election year coming up is going to be very interesting. There's a very interesting Senate race in the state of Massachusetts, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. There looks like a very active primary. In the Republican side, a lot of folks are getting involved. I agree. I think there'll be the midterm reaction from folks relating to the president's activities up until that time. I think there's a lot of different and exciting things that are happening that will be happening in the world of politics, and we'll see how that plays out. Again, as far as I'm concerned, the AG's office, that's the time when it's going to come back to its center, and it's going to focus on the people in this Commonwealth and get out of the business of politics. And so that's what I'm looking forward to.
Any worries or any concerns or any thoughts on, you know, being in the shadows of, you know, Charlie Baker, governor up for re-election? You've got, it seems though, you're going to have a big battle for U.S. Senate with Elizabeth Warren being up, and you already have a field of Republicans that are assembling to run against her. Do you have any concerns about being kind of in the shadows of races like that? Are you like going, hey, I don't care.
I don't think, I can only control what I do and what my message is, and that's really what I'm focused on. We're going to work very hard. We've already gotten a tremendous amount of positive response from our supporters, and so we're really excited about doing what we're going to do, and we believe that during this process that people are going to, this message will resonate, and they'll recognize that, hey, maybe the office has become too politicized. You know, the last time a Republican was Attorney General was approximately 50 years. It's been 50 years since a Republican has held that seat. Now, up until the current Attorney General, the office wasn't as politicized, but this is the most politicized this office has been. And so I think it's an opportunity for common sense to be back in that office to help the people in Massachusetts.
We've been speaking with Dan Shores, running for Attorney General. Dan, we just got about 2 or 3 minutes left here in this Labor Day segment of Monday Night Talk. Folks want to find out more. What are you doing in regards to getting your footprint out there on social media or on the internet?
Sure. Everything channels through our website, danshores.com. That's danshores, one word, .com. And everything channels through there. You'll see on that right away, you'll see a letter from me, which goes over my background. It goes over the key issues that I'm focused on in this race. And there's also a volunteer form and also a contribution form. And we would be grateful for any support that any of the listeners can provide. And you can learn it there. And if you want to reach out, get in contact with our campaign, you can do that through the website as well. That's danshores.com.
You want to end with a sad note about how here we are, Labor Day, and we're it's the end of summer. How do you know?
I thought you were going to say Julian Edelman's injury. That's what I thought you were going to say.
That's another subject for another
day. But on the positive side, absolutely. I think, it was a great summer, and fall around here is beautiful. So we're really looking forward to that. And so it's a great part of the world. We love Massachusetts. We live on the Cape. We live in Sandwich, and it's a beautiful part of one of the most beautiful spaces on the planet. And the South Shore is beautiful, obviously, as well. This is where I grew up. So I'm looking forward to a nice fall season.
Well, we thank you very much for coming in and kind of talking about your campaign. We'll look forward to talking with you more down the road as things start to happen, as races start taking shape. Maybe we even get you in here to do a political forum, of course. To check in with the news department and find out what they've got planned, if that's one of the things they got planned. We are going to step aside here on this edition of Monday Night Talk. When we come back, we have a couple of candidates who are running for office in Brockton. The city elections just a couple of weeks away, the preliminary, September 19th, and then in November, the general election. In just a few moments, you'll get to hear from two of those candidates right here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 FM WATD.
the South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Thank you for staying with us here on your Labor Day edition of Monday Night Talk. Of course, heard on 959 FM in Marshfield. And as we've been doing over the past couple of weeks, trying to get the word out about candidates in the city of Brockton. There is a city election every 2 years, and so happens it falls on this year. And we're doing our best to give candidates kind of an unconventional opportunity to come in, have a conversation, talk a little bit about their campaigns, and not necessarily have to sit across from somebody who is seeking the same seat or office, but to at least unto themselves be able to talk about their campaign. And we've offered this opportunity not only to new candidates or candidates who are, again, seeking office, but also to the incumbent. And we kind of do the same thing with the incumbents. We keep them, have them as a group, but unto themselves, not where there's like another at-large counselor sitting next to another at-large counselor. It's very different and unique. Joining us for this segment is Joanne Zygmunt. She is running for Ward 6 City Council. Joanne, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You got it. And running for the office of mayor, we have Mike Carroll. Mike, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you.
And I want to thank both of you. I know it was kind of interesting. We've never met before, but I was able to use social media to be able to reach out to you and have you join us here this evening to talk about your campaigns and get folks to a little bit of an appetizer as to who you are, why you're seeking office, some of the things that are concerning you, and some of the things that you're hearing from the city residents, whether it's in the city as a whole or in, you know, the particular ward. So we'll start with Mike. Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind.
My name is Mike Carroll, running for mayor of Brockton. Moved to Brockton when I was about 19, so I've been a resident of the city for a little over 14 years. I've been a homeowner for about 9 years now. I currently work as a food service director. I've held that job for about 6.5 years. That's pretty much it.
Okay. And Joanne, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm born and raised in Brockton. I've lived in Ward 6 for over 30 years now. I'm a homeowner, also in the Brookfield School area. I have a undergraduate degree from Boston University in political science and a master's in urban planning from University of College London. So I spent a little bit of time in London, which was amazing. And I'm running for city councilor because I feel like the pace of positive change it's not good enough for me. So I think we can do better.
Why did you, it seems interesting, both of you, you're both in crowded fields, which will be trimmed come the preliminary on September 19th. What have you learned since you've been out there knocking on doors and meeting people, or at least telling people that you are seeking office? Joanne?
I've been learning a lot. I've been out on the doors quite a bit. One of the biggest concerns, and I've heard this in other wards as well from other people running, is the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The roads are a big deal. People are concerned. In my ward especially, there are a lot of private ways, which means that those roads aren't eligible for paving. So that's an issue that needs to be worked on as well. So getting more money for roads, definitely a priority. Also hearing a lot about the school cuts. People are very concerned about that. And that all just relates back to the city being financially sound. And that's what people's issues generally fall down to, is the roads, the schools, public safety. All that eventually comes back to the money and to the budget. And how can we make the city more financially robust? How can we bring in more revenue? And what can, you know, can I, as a future city councilor, knock on wood, fingers crossed, you know, do about that?
Mike, give us your thoughts as to seeking office, running. Again, you have a crowded field. I think you're one of, what, four, five, six people, including the incumbent who are...
Six.
Yeah. What made you say, you know what, I've had enough, and I think I want to seek office?
Just overall how the city's being run for the past 4 years. I think it's slowly deteriorating. I felt that the other candidates weren't bringing the same thing I could, which is I'm going to focus on revenue. I mean, we generate revenue. We're able to give back to those areas that need it, whether it's education, police, fire, or other organizations who don't receive anything right now that help our community greatly, especially with the homeless.
How do you feel that your life's experience, your education, will help you get the attention of the voters? You know, and what's your platform going out there, talking to people, whether you're holding a general event or just having a door-knocking session in a particular neighborhood? Joanne?
So I have a lot of experience working on small business and nonprofit development. So for the last over 10 years now, I've been involved in the startup world. The first nonprofit that I worked for 6 years, I joined them when they were a team of 2.5, and we grew to over a team of 12. And we had to do that through hard work, through grant writing, through everybody focusing on different functions within the organization. So I have a very diverse background when it comes to things like marketing, cost-benefit analysis, budget management, project management. And I've been involved in the startup sector on the for-profit side as well. So I feel like my experience in the entrepreneurial sector and my experience in the innovation realm in general, especially here in Boston and on the South Shore, I think that's going to bring a different perspective to the city council. And I think what we need is new ideas, and I feel like I can bring those.
It's interesting that both of you, that there's an incumbent in the race. I know, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we actually had an individual who was in where he was part of a race that has, you know, there are three candidates. The week prior to that was another person, a woman who is seeking office, and there's no incumbent. But you both have incumbents in the race. And it's kind of interesting because with Ward 6, you have a one-term city councilor, rather young individual, but is, you know, nonetheless an incumbent. And then you have an incumbent in the mayoral race, somebody who is seeking a third term, something that hasn't been achieved in a while since the Jack Units administration, where I think Jack was elected five times to office, and he was able to stay in office for 10 years, and he's hoping to at least join the ranks of a Jack Units and seek and win a third term. Give me your thoughts, Jack, Mike.
On him winning?
Just on the thought of having an incumbent, you know, the incumbent in the race and some of the challenges.
Obviously, his war chest of money. I mean, I'm not going to look too much at that. If I pass the primaries, obviously that's going to mean more then. I hope to raise more money if I pass the primaries. I think it'd be a lot easier. I mean, now with so many candidates out there, it's hard to get people to donate. I mean, I think everyone's still up in the air on each candidate. I think we all need to get out there and spread our message to get the attention we need. And I've had a few small donations, but nothing compared to what he has. So I think that's going to be my challenge if I pass the primary.
Joanne, your thoughts?
So it's always challenging to win against an incumbent because they have an established name. And in my situation in particular, the third challenger in my race ran 2 years ago as well. So he has an advantage in terms of name recognition too. But I think what's most important is just getting out there and talking to people on the doorstep. And I feel like if I can meet as many people as I possibly can, then that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I'm going to focus on, because it's both a learning opportunity and, you know, a strategy. You know, I'd much rather do that than put an advertisement in a paper. Mm. And that's if you have a large war chest. Those are the kinds of things that you do. But ultimately, I think what we need in this city is grassroots change. I think Absolutely. We need more community engagement. And I think we do that on the doorstep.
How often have you two crossed paths. This is the first time.
Never. I was going to reach out to her within a week, and I was a couple days late, and I reached out to her last night saying, oh, you're both going on the radio tomorrow. I'll meet you tomorrow. And hopefully we can have a discussion after this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as being new to running for, is this, I would think, Joanne, this is your first time running for office?
Yes, I've never run before.
And same for you, Mike?
Correct.
Okay. How do you strategize? I mean, who did you reach out to have somebody help you get an idea as to how you should tackle a campaign? Now, I know it's different if you've been part of a group. Maybe you've helped somebody else run for a city office, or you've helped somebody running for state office try to get in that. But I think it's a totally different animal when it's yourself and you have to organize it and you have a vision as to how you want to accomplish it. Mike, how did you try to organize to how to get out and get your name out? Well, how have you?
Just the whole process in general?
The whole process so far to this point.
I reached out to a couple people who were involved in politics before, not local. I asked advice. I mean, my first priority was to try to find a campaign manager, and that was very difficult entering so late in the race. I had a campaign manager do a favor to help me get the ball rolling, but she had was already committed to somebody else's. And I've asked locally. Finally, I actually found a campaign manager about a week and a half ago now. Somebody who's has an immense amount of passion for the city. I think I got very lucky that he accepted. Mm-hmm. He was actually somebody who was challenging me with my plan and questions. We ended up meeting. We sat down. We ended up having a three-hour-long conversation. I asked if he would like to be part of my campaign. He said he'd think about it. A few weeks later, I reached back out to him, and I said, hey, I've met with 6-7 other people. I don't get the good feeling I get from you. I would really appreciate it if you would think about that. And he thought about it, and he got back to me that day, and he agreed, which I'm extremely grateful for.
So basically, and this is a question that I've asked. I know I asked a couple of weeks ago, because speaking with John McGarry, who's the executive director of the City Elections Commission, one of his concerns is folks running for the right reason, not because there are other folks who are part of an administration or other folks who are part of a group that wants to somehow have more control in the city, but that people are running for the right reason. Do you feel that you both are running for the right reasons, Joanne?
Yeah, absolutely. So I essentially am running because I've gotten frustrated and angry. And I've gotten frustrated and angry because I care about where I live and the city that that surrounds me. I've traveled a lot in my career, and I've seen ways that things could be done that I feel like we could be doing in Brockton, given that we are a city of, you know, roughly almost 100,000 people, mm-hmm. with a pretty significant budget, too. So I'm running because I feel like we can do better, and it's a service. It's not because I want to be a lifelong career politician. If I wanted to do that, I would have started a long time ago. I did do political science as an undergraduate degree, but I did that because I wanted to work in the nonprofit sector from the advocacy side of things. I always believed that it was important for the nonprofit sector, for the grassroots and community organizations, to participate in the policymaking process. And so that was my focus for many, many years. And then I decided to run because I felt like I had the experience and could bring something different to Brockton. But I also have a little bit of an advantage because I am a recent graduate of Emerge Massachusetts, which trains women Democrats to run for public office. So I graduated in June from that program, which teaches you everything in terms of fundraising, strategy, how to find a campaign manager, all that kind of stuff. So it was unbelievably useful. But I started that program thinking that actually I would be a campaign manager for somebody else. And then I decided to run myself a little bit later.
Same with you, Mike. It was it something, you know, that you felt that, like Joanne, she's frustrated,
yeah, absolutely.
Not happy. Was it a similar situation?
It's pretty much the exact same thing. I was frustrated. I think the city can do much better, given its location. We're in the center between the Cape, Boston, New Bedford, Providence, off of a major highway, two exits, where easy access to three major highways, three commuter rail stops. Yep. I think Brockton should be thriving. I do not understand why not. And I mean, I know why not now, but I think we need to start looking at how to change the perception of Brockton rather than build it up right at this moment. I mean, we have great small businesses in the, you know, downtown popping up. But I mean, I went to go to a coffee shop a couple weeks ago downtown, and it was closed. So the coffee shop is closed on the weekend. So that tells me that the local government, like the courthouse or city hall, they're the ones making it able for these businesses to be opened. And if you're going to keep rebuilding and trying to build, you need to rely on surrounding towns to support a local economy and bring their money in and spend it there. Other than that, it's not going to work.
Well, I know that a lot of work has been done over the past number of years, and I think it started with the Balzotti administration and has continued on with the Carpenter administration, and that is to try to revitalize and rebuild the city center. And I know that it's been a tough nut to crack because you have the Westgate Mall, mm-hmm. which is away from the center. And what do you really have that to attract at the particular time when Balzotti was looking to try to do things? You had the Trinity Project on the Enterprise Block and other things like that. The idea was is to try to find reasons to bring people, foot traffic in the downtown area. Do you feel that so far the work to redevelop the downtown corridor is a success, or do you feel that there are hits and misses, and what you would like to do to work on those misses?
There are definitely hits and misses. I mean, like I said, when a coffee shop on the weekend is closed, I mean, that's a miss, I think. I think they should be open on the weekends. It comes back to changing the perception. I mean, you have a lot of people who are hesitant to come to shop in Brockton just because of the perception. They think it's dangerous. I think that's in and of itself is going to take a lot of work to fix. I mean, I also want to focus at main entrances when you come into Brockton, particularly Belmont Street. It's been under heavy construction for 2 years. The grass areas near the on and off ramps for the highway aren't maintained. I understand that's a state highway for the most part, but why aren't we holding the state accountable? Or if they can't do it, can we maintain it and send the state a bill? I mean, you can't expect people to want to bring businesses in when you're entering and it looks like that. I mean, every day I almost drive past that and I say, what a shame. You have a pile of granite slabs for sidewalks, large concrete pipes that have been there for over a year. I did notice some of the concrete pipes are missing, but why is that okay to have it out in the public? I mean, that possibly could be deterring businesses to come, which is making us lose revenue. I mean, I think that's something that needs to be taken care of right away.
Okay. Now, Joanne, while your ward is not anywhere near the downtown corridor, you, if successful in November, well, September, and then hopefully November, would be part of, you know, the city council and an 11-member panel committee that, you know, kind of helps oversees and discusses, especially when it comes to funding and financing for such projects like the downtown corridor, maybe two-way traffic on Main Street. Give me your thoughts.
So I think that downtown is only one part of Brockton, and that for a long time, especially my ward, Ward 6, has been somewhat overlooked. I think the Montello area, for example, I know in the Blueprint for Brockton, which is the city's development plan, that they are going to turn their attention to that area of the city in terms of redevelopment as well. But I think we need to, I think as Mike says, there's a lot of problems. One of those is perceptions. We do need people from outside the city to want to come into Brockton for whatever reason, for the coffee shops, for the shops of, you know, creative artists, for, you know, for some reason. That's definitely part of it. I think also what we need to do is make Brockton more business friendly. I've heard from a lot of businesses that the permitting and licensing processes can sometimes take forever, months and months and months, during which time businesses are losing money. I've heard of businesses wanting to expand in Brockton and then pulling back from that because their licensing and permitting processes were just taking so long and they had to jump through so many hoops that it just wasn't worth the time and effort for them anymore. I would love to see something like a one-stop shop at City Hall where local businesses can come and find out exactly what they have to do to open up shop here. Even things like finding out, we have a lot of vacant buildings, finding out, all right, well, what state are these vacant buildings in? As a small business owner, maybe it might be viable for me to lease one of those from the city, fix it up a little bit, maybe get it at a discounted rate because of all the maintenance that I'd have to do. I mean, I think there's a lot of creative ways that we can look to attract more business, but also market the city better.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. Like you said, making it difficult for permits. Like I believe it was Sorelli Foods who jumped ship out of Brockton because it was very difficult. Mm. I mean, I would like to bring distribution centers such as food or retail. Like we lost Amazon. I don't know why. No one can answer that question. But I think we need to start focused there before we start with retail. If we're going to do retail, we need smaller retail. I think larger retail is a dying breed because of online sales. Yeah, I mean, you look at the mall and Macy's closing ship, not just there, but in Taunton. Mm. I think developing individualized, customizable tax incentives to lure companies is another big part. We have to look at the insurance rates for these companies in Brockton. I don't think we factor that in when trying to wheel and deal and get them in here.
Mm. And off the back of that, too, I think as well, coming back to these problems with cuts to the school budget, needing more money for infrastructure, for public safety, for police and fire, our revenue stream at the moment is heavily imbalanced to residential property taxes and state funds. And I really do think that if we got more commercial funds in here and a much larger commercial revenue base, we could do a lot more in this city. And
that's exactly what the city needs. Yeah. 100%. We need to fund where it's needed.
I like how you two are feeding off each other. I was hoping that we were going to have a third party here, but the last minute it was a cancellation and the individual could make it. But you are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 FM WATD in Marshfield, also 1460 AM in Brockton. And we have two fine candidates are seeking office in the city of Brockton. Joanne Zygmunt seeking Ward 6 City Council. She's one of three, which includes the incumbent and Mike Carroll, who is in a group of about a half a dozen who are seeking, hopefully, to be one of two people to be on the ballot in November for mayor. And that's what we're doing here, is having a unique conversation. We got a little less than 7 or 8 minutes left here. And education was something that was just brought up by both of you. Specifically, Joanne had mentioned education. And we know that the past 2 years, we have seen a deficit. We know that the superintendent and the school committee put forth a budget, and a lot of blame has been put on the back of the new charter school and how funding is calculated by the state, where we saw, respectively, for fiscal 2017, it was a $10 million deficit. For fiscal 2018, which we are currently in, it was $16 million. Now, I don't know how much of that was dwindled down or chipped away by monies that was coming from the state or that the city was able to fortify when the final budget was passed before June 30th. But give me your thoughts in regards to education, because if you have consecutive years where we've seen a growing deficit, what can be done, at least on the city side, in order to provide more funding so we're not seeing massive deficits and we're not seeing or hearing that, oh no, you know, that the usually when we're talking about there's not enough money, class sizes, little Johnny's going to be in a class of, you know, 35 or 40 students, or this program's getting cut, or sports at this school's being cut. Give me your thoughts, Mike.
I think it's great that they're going to pursue the state and attempt to sue the state, and they talked about Prop 2.5 to fix the problem. I personally think that's just a Band-Aid, and I think by 2019 we'll be in the same position unless we start generating revenue. Again, it's just a short-term fix. I would like to see the school system try to generate some of their own revenue. I would make suggestions and support something like developing 3 to 5 certificate programs, like after school for adults in the community could, you know, learn a trade of some sorts. Something I did in my current place, I do not do this anymore, even though it did work, is you can provide an adult daycare with meals. Each daycare typically has about 30 people in it, 5 days a week, closed holidays. Now, if you can utilize the school's cafeteria, which they're set up for commercial-wise, and they have a menu which you can piggyback off of and make small minor adjustments to fit the nutritional components for the adults, that right there for each daycare, you have the potential of making about $32,000. So even if each school were to pick up 2 or 3, you have the potential of $70,000 to $100,000. I truly believe when you scrape pennies, millions comes together. That would just be part of it. But it's something I would strongly suggest the school committee to look into and start supporting itself. for a long-term fix opposed to these short-term fixes. I mean, if we were to increase the property tax to 2.5, that's not going to cover everything. You're going to have new pension payouts, salary increases, the cost of goods or services the city currently provides. It's not going to be enough.
Okay. Joanne?
I agree with a lot of that. I think, so I went to a meeting with the school superintendent last week or earlier this week, and they did say that they were looking at ways of involving private businesses. So, for example, sponsor a school or sports teams. So I think, as Mike says, we need to look at creative ways of having the school bring in some revenue to support their activities. I also think that we, as the city, as a city councilor, the focus really needs to be on increasing revenue more generally within the city. And if we do that, like, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that schools, and I learned this at the meeting that I went to, a lot of schools in Massachusetts, a lot of school communities like Newton, like Wellesley, they will put twice what they're required to by the state into their school budgets. So they'll put in like an extra million or $2 million because they can, because the city has that revenue, and they'll put it in there. Our city doesn't have that revenue. So we're literally stuck between, you know, a rock and a hard place. We've got to do with the money that we've got, and we can't rely on the state anymore. So I think we need to look to ourselves to start generating that revenue and thinking creatively about what we can do as a city to give ourselves more money to do all the things that we want to do.
Yeah, there's no way the school's ever going to be able to maintain their own budget. But again, the, like you are 100% correct, the city needs to do more in generating revenue to give back to and cut and find the money.
We got a little less than 3 minutes left here. Is there an issue or something that you did have a chance to mention or talk about briefly, but you'd like to at least share an insight to? And if folks want to find out more information, maybe they can turn to a website or a Facebook page that they could get more information and get a little bit more depth as to where you stand on it. Joanne?
So there's for folks in my Ward 6, there's a lot of diversity in issues. So I think anybody can contact me anytime to talk about anything. My campaign phone number is 508-521-9891, or it's joanne4brockton@gmail.com. One of my big issues as well is the water situation in Brockton. I think we all should be very carefully looking at what happens in terms of hooking up to the MWRA or the desal plant. It's going to be a lot of money that the city's going to have to invest no matter which solution we choose. And again, that comes back to the financial stability of our city.
Mike?
I would agree with the desalination plant right there off the bat. I think, you know, to purchase a building as old as it is, it's starting to fall apart. $78 million, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. The land valuation isn't near that. By the time we end up paying it off, it's going to be $100 million, I believe.
Yep.
A lot of unanswered questions. Are those employees then going to become city employees with city benefits such as health care and pension?
Sure.
And I did notice, looking it up in the trust, it went from having two managers to six managers when we go to buy it, which I don't know why. I don't want to make accusations, but I thought that looked a little odd to me.
Okay.
I think that is a poor purchase. If you want to learn more about me, I have a website, www.electmikecarroll.com. That's two R's, two L's. You can look me up on Facebook. Just search Mike Carroll Brockton, and I should pop right up.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Mike Carroll, and Joanne Zygmunt for joining me, and wish you the best of luck come September 19th. And I, you as a voter out there who is listening to this, get involved. Understand where your candidates stand on the issues. You have two candidates here who just gave you information to reach out to them or find out what they're all about. Before you go in and decide who you're going to vote for, at least have an idea as to where everybody stands and how they would best help or suit the city of Brockton. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Oh, what a summer weekend. Made for kids. Pop them in the Jeep with the skateboards. No storage problem with those boards. That's the flaming Windfire Fusion Kinza boards, to be exact. And there you are. The ocean. The parking lot. An irresistible challenge to any board trickster. Weaving through cars, dogs, coolers, umbrellas, admiring throngs. You just gotta try the extreme backside 180 double kick flip. Ah, perfect execution. Well, except for sending the boys straight through the windshield of Dad's pride and joy.
Sorry, Dad. There's always a bright side. Insurance pays. Tiny replaces. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call. Oh, and Dad, the skateboard is okay.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen. Say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Hey, welcome back for our final segment of Monday Night Talk, heard here on 95.9 WATD. And joining us, we have not had this guest for, it's been a while, but, you know, I thought about the helpful hints that she has given us over the years, and immediately contacted her for this, you know, special, even though the kids have already gone back to school prior to this past weekend, this Labor Day weekend. We welcome back the one and only Dr. Kate Roberts. Dr. Kate, how are you?
I'm great, Kevin. How are you?
I'll tell you, it's interesting seeing it. It's myself, I don't have to worry about the my little ones going back to school. They now have little ones that are, you know, going to school.
Good for you.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you get lucky, but you can't think that nobody else has this problem and they're not dealing with it, because you're going from the relaxation and the ease of the summer. And a lot of times when we as a culture, especially here in America, when it goes from, you know, school letting out in June, usually it's the planning begins, and folks end up planning vacations and trips, and it's leisure. But then when it gets a little bit of a chill in the air, it's time to send the kids back to school and back on schedule. So you were kind enough to put together some tips, some back-to-school tips, to help parents and their children be able to get better acclimated when it comes time to getting the kids on the bus and kind of making it a gradual process. Does that sound right?
It does. And I think that a natural way that people have looked at it is the change of seasons. Things start to get cooler, and that's the signal that, you know, fall is coming, time to go back to school. Mm-hmm. I have to say, with the weather being so strange this summer, I think some families, myself included, didn't feel like it was quite, you know, the same as the extended vacation we have in the summer with warm, sunny weather. It was off and on, you know?
Right.
So maybe a little gypped, but back to school is here, and it does increase the pace of life considerably.
Okay. So, if you will, we actually have two segments here. Two sections. I shouldn't say two segments, because then our listeners here will get confused. But you were kind enough to kind of give me two separate sets of tips. And one, I think, is kind of a generalization of tips. And then the other is on the different, you know, educational levels, whether it's elementary
different
school.
Different ages of the kids,
right,
and what they need, and
right,
things like that.
Exactly.
Yep.
So, if you will, let's start with your 16 tips, 1 through 16. I'll let you kind of go tick down them. I'll interrupt if I have a question, if I want to kind of pop in with some thoughtful words or even a question of my own.
Well, I think, you know, the first one for parents, these are really for parents, you know, staying calm. Is that what yours says? First,
yep.
One, stay
yes.
calm,
yes,
embrace
ma'am.
Uncertainty. You know, I think it's easy to get all wound up about the new grade level that your child is in, maybe the new teacher, some of the other changes, and whatever's unfamiliar. Parents are very hands-on these days, and they tend to want to control situations that aren't controllable. So I would say try to take a step back and be calm and just see what happens and then deal with it if there's a big problem.
Can I ask you a question? How have things changed from when you and I went to grade school to today's parents? How has that dynamic changed?
Well, I hope you agree. It has changed.
Oh, it has.
I can't tell you exactly, like, how it happened, but I can tell you it is very different. I mean, I think that when we were kids, you know, whatever happened, happened. And right. We just kind of dealt with it, and so did our families. But I think now it's having to, and I'm guilty of it myself, but, you know, really feeling like it's going to be the worst thing in the world if things don't go exactly as planned, and other people that you know might have this situation lined up or that, and you feel like you're behind the eight ball if you don't do the same thing. And there's just a lot more stress, pressure, competition, that kind of thing.
It's funny. That's a great segment because your next, a great segue, because your next tip is, you know, don't keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah, I mean, we did that when we were kids, like our families, but not to this extent. I think that social media has really exacerbated it because you'll see, like, the perfect families on there with their perfect school supplies and, you know, all this stuff that's organized and laid out, and you haven't done it yourself, and you think, oh, my gosh, I'm the worst person in the world. You know, I mean, social media gives us an unrealistic glimpse into what other people say is their real life.
Right.
But I don't think it's accurate. So I think focusing on what you can do, what you find the priority is, and having to stay centered in that way. Don't get distracted.
Another great suggestion that you have or tip is to be non-reactive. I know a lot of times, and, you know, you use the social media element, there's too many times that I see parents reacting to, you know, little Billy in a situation that he has endured while in school, instead of being so much the structure, the rock, as you put it. Kind of explain why it's important that as a parent you try not to be so emotional or reactive to a situation in front of your child.
I think that children don't have perspective. They don't understand that whatever is happening today that seems monumental and huge is really not, and things pass and you get over them, whatever disappointments you have. Parents need to know that. They should know it from their own life experience. So without that life experience, small things can become huge, you know, within a matter of seconds. And I think that that's a big problem for families, is losing perspective.
Mm. Okay. You also say to be realistic. Be realistic. How do you mean be realistic?
I mean that you have to know what your limits are so that you're not going to have, you know, an elaborate dinner that you might have been able to make in the summer, or you're not going to have as much time over dinner, et cetera, when you're in the middle of a busy school schedule. You know, I mean, kids, like it or not, tend to be overscheduled, and so there might not be a lot of time. You might not have as much time if you're involved in driving to activities and things like that. And so be realistic. Don't put pressure on yourself that you know you're not going to succeed.
And it should be noted that, you know, the time parameters are different, especially if you have your kids on a schedule to go to bed earlier, to be able to plan for homework and stuff like that. That has to be factored in, too.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard to know how much time these things are going to take.
Right.
So you just have to keep your limit, you know, keep your expectations low in the beginning until you figure out how you're going to fit it all in.
You also say in your next tip to plan family time. How does that change when it comes to school?
Well, I think that family time over the summer is vacations and maybe, you know, having a breakfast in the morning together. You know, during the school year, kids are up and out, and then they come back, and like I said, they've got a lot of different things to do. So I think that family time could be 20 minutes a night. You know, it doesn't have to be a dinner, especially if your kids do sports. But it should be a time when people come together and talk about their day and try to reconnect. It's not so much the length of time that they do it in each and every day. It's more the consistency, so it happens every day, and the quality of the interaction. People shouldn't be on their smartphones and things like that during that time.
Right. And I think you also point out that it's might be best to, if you want to have extended family time, maybe you try to plan something during the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I work with a lot of families who have teenagers, and they don't have that time with their teenagers during the weekend. And, you know, the teenagers have other priorities, and I encourage parents to, you know, kind of demand, insist. 2-3 hours during a weekend is going to be family time. We have to have that time. And I think that studies show when parents make that a priority, kids benefit.
Okay. You also say to connect with others. What does that mean?
I think that you can get so focused on the immediate needs, the logistics, just taking care of whatever needs to be taken care of, and I think there's always something else to do. So it is important to kind of put that stuff aside and make some social time for you or your family to get together with others and just have fun.
Now, 7 and 8, you say to practice relaxation and get sleep. Put both of those into perspective.
Well, I think that, you know, practice relaxation means that you understand when you're starting to get stressed and are able to have some self-control, use some strategies, do a little bit of meditation, do a little bit of visualization to keep yourself calm, either before, during, or after stressful events. And getting enough sleep, you know, people really underestimate the value of sleep, so 7-8 hours is really what most adults need, and it has to be a priority, otherwise it will catch up with them.
Okay. And you also stress that if it comes to when you move into this type of scheduling, especially with the kids going back to school, you learn how to or practice prioritizing.
Yeah, you can't do everything. You can't do everything for them, and you can't do everything for yourself. So what is it that's really important that's going to make you have a better day, make you have a more positive outlook? And, you know, for some people, actually, you know, for most people, it's some form of exercise because it is a way to physically de-stress. And then other people have the other things that they want to do, but trying to make sure it's regular and routine is essential.
Again, we're speaking with Dr. Kate Roberts. She's a personal coach and a psychologist, child psychologist. And we have her on from time to time to talk about these very things. Back to school is a perfect example, and finding a way to not only get the kids acclimated, the family acclimated, but also kind of get yourself on course as well. And so the next tip you offer is to have you time.
Yes, because I think having you time, you as the parent, really helps you to stay calm and centered in the midst of all the craziness. You know, I'm speaking like people are going off to a war or something, but I mean,
right.
It is so intense today for kids and families that are enrolled in school. So I think that having you time means that when you're not having you time, you're going to be more effective, less reactive.
All right. And another thing that you point out is affirmations and how it, and why it's important to practice them. Why should we practice? Why should we be affirmative in our actions and what we do?
There's been some research that has shown that it will change our physiology if we think consistently in a positive way. And we might have one or two mantras or statements like, you know, I'm doing the best I can today. So telling that to yourself, having certain physical postures, even, you know, the Wonder Woman pose, increases hormones, which help to increase certain levels of or decrease cortisol, which is a hormone. And it helps people to stay physiologically less stressed, which helps everything.
Okay. You also said to practice intentional living. What is that?
I think that gets back to what I was saying earlier about making that family time, no smartphones, being intentional about it, not just, you know, okay, so we're in the same room now because it happened that way. just by chance we're all home at the same time. It has to be more intentional, like you're committed to it, it's a goal, you're going to have this family time every day.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I've noticed over the past couple of holidays in my household, it's funny, with the whole family is gathered, yet everybody is, it's almost, they're like locked into their own little personal space with their smartphone. And I'm like, this is intriguing. There used to be a time when everybody would be gathered around the TV or the radio, and at least there would be an interaction. But you have everybody kind of staring into that little, you know, 4-inch
box. It is. And, you know, I'm going to encourage anybody who's listening to read the article in Atlantic Monthly this month on smartphones and technology for children and families, and maybe I can come back on and talk about it. But, you know, there's new research out, and it really does show the alienation, the isolation. Like you said, everyone's in the same room,
yep,
but they're not benefiting from it because they're in their own little space with their smartphone.
Yeah, I got to tell you, while it's a fantastic invention and it is so helpful, there's so many times I was driving on the highway, you know, a couple of days ago, noticing people, they were more worried about what was going on their phone than what was going on the road, you know, on the highway, you know, going 55, 60 miles an hour. I was amazed by it, you know.
They can't get away from it. It's like an addiction, you know, even when they're driving.
Yeah. So the next couple here, I'm going to kind of combine these two. Be thoughtful, be affectionate. Put those into perspective.
I think that, you know, by being thoughtful, that's you're thinking about the people around you, what they need, not just your own needs, trying to teach that and role model it for your children. And then being affectionate, make sure that you don't forget how important it is to express your feelings towards your kids, show them that it's okay to say, I love you, be emotional, that kind of thing. So I think that keeping that as a priority, despite all the distractions that happen when people go back to school.
And then you have here, be active at the end of the school day transition. How important is that?
I think it's really important. I think schools, you know, they've gotten rid of recesses. There isn't as much activity for kids who really need to be active. So I love the idea of being able to walk home or going for a walk when you get home or a bike ride to keep that outlet, that physical outlet for kids. So then when they do need to focus, which in, you know, 1, 2, 3 weeks is going to be homework. Not yet, but it's coming.
Yep.
And if they have that outlet, they're going to be much more ready to sit down and do it.
And then the final tip, and this is something that some people struggle at, and that is saying no.
It's hard to say no. It really is. It's hard to say no, especially when you can see the benefit in, you know, maybe that one activity. And when you have one activity times four, now it's four activities.
Right.
And I think that just making sure that you know why you're saying no and you know what's best and sticking to it.
Is it a cultural thing that we can't say no, but yet behind the scenes we say to ourselves that, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I should have said no, but you can't, that someone can't, you know, do it reactively or do it sincerely and then give a wholesome reason why they're saying no?
I think it's a cultural thing. I think kids have expectations. I think that, you know, sometimes if you have a lot of activities going on, then you don't have to structure the time as much. Kids are so used to having structure. So, oh, I'll just put them in this structure, that structure, the next structure. And it's a trade-off. It's really tough to, you know, get used to kids having downtime that they need to manage and also saying no, but there's real benefits to it over time.
Yeah, I got to tell you, as a kid, no was probably my mom and dad's favorite word. And, you know, after
not
a while.
Not today.
Yeah, not today. No. No is practiced on a regular basis. And, you know, I didn't suffer any physical or emotional scars from it that I know of, but I thought it kind of put things when they did say yes, it was, you know, I had, you know, there was a reason, it was earned, there was purpose to it. It wasn't just everything being yesed. There was a reason.
Well, and I don't know if you remember this, but I mean, most kids, when they ask for something, they don't really even know why, or right. It's not that important. They're just asking to see if they can get away with it.
It's a test. So, again, we are speaking with Dr. Kate Roberts, a personal coach, a psychologist. Want to find out more, check out some of the things that she's working on. You still do a blog, correct? A regular blog?
Yes.
You can go to her website, www.drkateroberts.com. And we're talking about giving some tips in regards to easing back into going to school. Dr. Kate's going to be with us for about another 10 minutes as we wrap up this Labor Day edition of Monday Night Talk. So I've transitioned to the other tip sheet, back to school tips for getting through transitions. And talk to me, you've got four bullet points to start out with. Getting off to a great start when it comes to the new school year. Do you want to kind of tick those off, starting with the stay positive?
Sure. I mean, when I say the new school year, some students are going to a new school, some students are changing grade. You know, from one grade to the next is a big leap. It's not just, you know, next door to where they were last year. So you want to make sure that you stay positive, that you're upbeat, even if your child is nervous and anxious, and that's normal. Try to reframe anxiety to excitement. You know, I know you're excited, that kind of thing, but stay positive. And then make sure that if they do have a lot of questions, that you take them as much as you can. And even though they started school this week, a lot of them, you could still, you know, talk to other people, try to get some questions answered that they didn't find out already the answers to. Prepare them for the what-ifs, you know, so things that are still coming up that they haven't experienced are things like sports after school clubs. You know, what if my friends aren't where they're supposed to be? What if I forget something? That kind of thing. So teach them about how they can self-advocate, how they can problem-solve in the moment. That's really important to sort of have them take some ownership over that. And then it's hard to see your kids struggle. It's hard to see them have disappointments and anxiety, but I think that parents need to take care of their own emotions, and kids will be very resilient to any of these kinds of stresses.
Okay. So what's interesting here is you give specific tips through for each transitional year. So starting with preschool to kindergarten, that can be very interesting, going from preschool to a little bit more structure in kindergarten, right?
Yes. I mean, I think that kindergarten isn't what it was when I was in school. You know, it was a lot of playtime and so forth.
Yep.
They do a lot more academics now, and kids aren't necessarily ready for those, so that can be stressful. But the basic things are that, you know, it is a lot more structured than preschool. There's sharing and turn-taking that's emphasized, communicating, cleaning up after each other and themselves, and just, you know, being able to tolerate differences in each other. And so it's like a social curriculum, I guess, social-emotional curriculum, with some reading and writing thrown in there. And, you know, I think that when kids come home and they have comments or questions for their parents, you know, they'll say things like, I missed all of playtime, and parents might freak out. You know, but they don't have a sense of time. So if your kid says to you, I missed this whole great thing, know that they probably missed 1 minute of 15, and to them it's everything, and don't overreact to that.
Okay. So then going from kindergarten to first grade, going to elementary school, it's so different from back in the day. Talk to us about making that transition.
Well, I think that it really is very focused on reading right away in first grade and writing. And it's going to be, you know, kids learn those things at different ages and in different stages of development. And so there's going to be a fair number that feel like they're not able to do it. And parents just need to realize that what they can't do 1 week, they'll easily do the next week. So try to keep it in perspective and just let the process take care of itself.
And let's not forget the self-image, the social interaction, and getting better acclimated with their classmates.
Yeah, it's amazing. Even in first grade, girls can be very clicky. They can be exclusive of each other. Boys are more easygoing, but boys have high activity, you know, needs. So trying to instill that message of kindness, inclusion, sharing, all of that early on so that you break down that tendency to, you know, be nasty to their peers.
Now, things have changed since you and I have been in school, because I when I went to school, there was a junior high model. Now it's more of a middle school, and the middle school dynamic can start in fifth grade or sixth grade. Talk about making that transition from elementary school to going to, you know, there's another group of older kids that you're going to be a part of.
Yes. I mean, most schools have, like, the wing for sixth graders or fifth graders, yep, whatever the incoming age is. But you don't have to line up, you know, when you go to different classes. You're not just going to one or two classrooms. You're going to, you know, five or six. You're going freely. You get to go to the cafeteria and outdoors on your own. There's a lot more independence. You've got a locker. And so it's like anything else in life. With more independence, there's more responsibility. You're going to have, you know, five, six different teachers, and you're going to have to manage the different workloads from the teachers. So I think middle school is really about independence, taking some responsibility and ownership, initiative, that kind of thing, asking for help. Teachers aren't going to come up and say, oh, did you understand that? You're going to have to go tell them if you didn't.
Well, we just got another minute or two. Well, we've got about 2 minutes left here, but it gives us enough time to talk about the real big transition. When you're going from middle school to high school, talk about that transition and giving folks tips.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, that's the big thing. And my son is just starting ninth grade. And,
oh, bless you.
You know, ninth grade, you know, ninth grade counts. You know, that's what the message is. Because, of course, it goes through your GPA for college.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got the more pressure on your performance. You've got the classes that are tracked according to level, you know, honors and so forth.
AP, yep.
And, yeah, exactly. And then you've got the sports, you know, the tryouts for the first time. Not everybody makes it, that kind of thing. So there's just a lot more pressure. There's a lot of peer pressure. There's the whole sexual thing between girls and boys and drugs and alcohol. It's a lot. So I would say that for parents of kids this age, you know, really try to stay on top of it. Things get more complicated as kids get older, not easier. And know that, and know that whatever mistakes you make or they make, they're not dire, you know, and you're going to be able to recoup and try to have perspective more than ever.
Right. Those are high school years are probably in anybody's life the most awkward years, where an individual's trying to find themselves and kind of get their feet under them, because it's the launching point either into college, and depending on if your child is at a VOTEC, could be into the workforce. So it's definitely very interesting.
Right, first relationships, first,
yep,
you know, maybe drug and alcohol, first this, first jobs,
oh, yeah,
first that, and all that. So you just have to just, you know, it's a learning curve for everyone.
Again, Dr. Kate's been our guest for this segment, and the segment is flown, Dr. Kate. We want to thank you for joining us. Of course, Dr. Kate is a psychologist and parent coach up on the North Shore, and you can check out her website, drkateroberts.com. Anything you want to say quickly in closing?
No, I mean, I really enjoyed talking to you, Kevin, and, you know, check in with me in a month or two, and I'll let you know how it's going.
All right, sounds like a plan. Enjoy what remains of your Labor Day weekend, seeing that tomorrow we all go back to work and we get ready for the fall, and we'll definitely have to have those another conversation in about a month, especially in regards to getting acclimated for the holidays. That's right around the corner, too. That's another conversation we need to have, so be prepared for that.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Take care.
You
Thank
got
you.
It. That was Dr. Kate Roberts, who is our final guest of the evening. That's all the show that we have. We thank you very much for tuning into this Labor Day edition of Monday Night Talk. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD-FM Marshfield, WATD Brockton, 95.9 FM and 1460 AM.